we're fairly well versed now on the political consequences of inequality. It's undoubtedly contributed to the rise of populism. It's now definitely on the agenda, as you know, so people are starting to wrestle with whether it can be tackled. So good news, in other words. One of the world's leading economic thinkers, French-born but US-based Professor Marc Fleurbé, has been in Canberra this week giving the 2017 Passmore Lecture for the ANU's Centre for Moral, Social and Political Theory, proving, as he did so, that new language and imagination is possible, even in some of these intractable issues. He's also been working on a mammoth publication with 300 international colleagues on how to rethink questions of equality within societies and to tackle inequality. He's Professor of Economics and Humanistic Studies at Princeton University and brings a glittering array of publications and appointments to the table. Welcome now to Saturday Extra.
Thank you.
Look, we'll hear more about that book in a moment, but its key messages are, I gather, conclusions you've reached yourself about addressing inequality, and they're not the protectionism advanced by populists, as you say, neither the expansion of the welfare state. Now, could you tell me first, why not those things?
Well, people certainly need protection, right? And when you say that inequality has fueled populism, that's right. But it's not just inequality. It's really the insecurity that people feel when the basis of their economic life are shaken by globalization and also by technical change. And protectionism is a bad recipe for that because it can no longer work. The economy is so interconnected, and it's actually quite inefficient to close borders because it closes opportunities for exchanges, for even exchanges of ideas, not just goods and services. And so protectionism is really a solution of the past, so to speak.
And you would say that the protectionism was essentially the argument for reviving American manufacturing, etc., that Donald Trump put to, in order to win office.
Right, and that will not work.
Okay. Now the welfare argument, part of it?
The welfare state, that's something that's interesting because the welfare state is in turmoil now. It has somehow worked quite well after the war, and it has contributed to keeping the inequalities in check for quite a few decades. But now, under the pressure of globalization and after the financial crisis, many governments are under pressure. They have a large debt and so on. And so we have to think about reorganizing the welfare state on a more solid base, and that implies shifting the tax base toward things which, instead of distorting the economy, we talk about distortionary taxes, for instance, taxing labor is something that not only discourages labor, but it also makes labor more expensive for employers, and therefore it reinforces problems of unemployment. We need to find other tax bases, and there is an obvious kind of obvious solution there, which is that we have serious environmental problems, and we need to be very active about that. And in particular, we've been talking about the carbon tax for many years now. Mm. It is time to use such tools to find a new tax base for the welfare state. That's one leg of the argument. But the other thing is that when I was talking about empowering people, that means that if you think of the typical Trump voter, for instance, in the US, that's not someone who wants a welfare stipend from the government. That's someone who wants to have a good job and also to have some sense of being in control of his or her life.
Can I just interrupt you there? Because yeah, it's sure. quite interesting. I've heard this argument that people don't want welfare, they want jobs. I feel it's a very American argument, and it's tied into their real anxiety about government, which I don't think is echoed nearly the same way in, say, Britain and Australia, and maybe even your own home country of France. So, you know, I just wonder about this argument about welfare need. I mean, we've got a very tight welfare program here in Australia, actually,
yes.
Much more than most other parts of the world. I wonder whether you think...
You're right. Yes, it's true that the fear of government is a kind of American syndrome. But even in Europe, and I guess in Australia as well, the traditional income support methods are not exactly ideal to empower people. And so we need to think of other methods. So the way thinkers talk about this thing is to say that redistribution is something that's necessary because we need to provide basic income support. But pre-distribution is something that is worth thinking about. And what is pre-distribution? That's about changing the incomes that are generated in the market in order to make them more unequal to start with, so that the state has less redistribution to do afterwards. And how do you do pre-distribution?
So that's intervening in capitalism, really, to pre-distribution, is it?
Yes, somehow, exactly. And how can you do that? Well, an obvious and very fashionable idea is to provide a lot of education and better education to the workforce. That's an obvious solution, even though it's somewhat expensive. Healthcare, good healthcare, is also something that can help people, because when you have, and again, the situation in the US is quite appalling in this sense, you have a lot of problems of health that prevent people from being able to work. And so these are the obvious things, but there are a few things which are less obvious, and in particular one which I think is quite important, which is to look at the governance of economic organizations. And the key institution we have to look at is the corporation and the companies, where we have observed an increase in the pay gap between the CEOs and the rank and file workers. And this increase is not really justified by economic considerations. So if we could have a more transparent governance in firms, and also a more participatory governance, where the stakeholders, and in particular the workers, become part of the boards in firms, we would have less inequalities in the wages that are given by firms, and therefore less need for redistribution by the state.
It's very interesting, the work you've done here, because you make the point that in days gone past, the corporations were smaller, and actually people lived closer. The different hierarchies in the corporation, if I'm reading you correctly, lived closer together, so that if you had to make someone redundant, you might have to see them at mass next Sunday or down at the baker shop sort of thing. But these days, they don't even live anywhere near each other. They're in different realms of the world. And that this has increased the sense of loss of power of labour.
Absolutely. And the incentives for the decision makers in the economic sphere have radically changed. You were describing very well the situation decades ago, when you had small plants and where the boss of the plant knew everyone by his first name and indeed was essentially living in the same neighborhood. Now we have a situation where actually if you close a plant or a shop, it increases the bonus of the decision maker. And so I think it also increases the returns to the shareholders. So the incentives now are somehow separating the various interests that should be associated in the firm. And a way to make them more attuned to working together is to change the governance.
Okay, so let me just tell the listeners that Professor Marc Fleurbe from Princeton University is joining us, having given the 2017 Passmore Lecture for the ANU Centre for Moral, Social and Political Theory this week. Now, one of the things I like that you say is the possibility of treating contributors of different forms as partners. And you might even have, say, three component boards, where one tier is for workers, one's for suppliers, and maybe one's for customers, and one's for capital. You know, that's a very, I don't know how exactly that would work, but it certainly does reframe one's thinking.
Yes, and actually you have already experiments that go in that direction, right? So if you look at the large firms in Germany, they have this system of co-determination where workers have almost half of the seats in the board. And so you have also now something that happened in the US, the creation of benefit corporations, which are corporations which are not quite ordinary, because their mission is to serve a social purpose or a more general purpose or an environmental purpose.
Are they profit-making?
They are supposed to be surviving in the market, but their purpose is not just to make profit for the shareholders or for the owners. It is to serve a marginal goal. And actually, the change in governance of the firm that I was talking about should go together with a change in the mission of the corporation. So there was in the 60s, the traditional formulations of the mission, the purpose of the corporation, included broader social goals than just maximizing the shareholder value. So since the 80s and the 90s, we have really narrowed the purpose of the firm.
Where the shareholder gains much more than the community or labour. You know, I mean, people have been talking about that for 20 years, you know. And that really came in with Reagan and Thatcher, didn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it came before that. It actually came from thinkers like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, who were pushing. They were right, actually. There were good things in what Friedman and Hayek said. And I like to emphasize that. what I'm saying here is not at all anti-market, right? So the market is an extremely important device for the efficiency of the economy. And so it's completely compatible to be pro-market and to be also pro-democracy in the governance of the economy.
Okay. One thing before I let you go, you do also argue for reframing the language around inheritance taxes. Tell us why.
Oh, that's yes, that's an interesting idea that comes actually from John Stuart Mill. So it's not exactly a new idea. Inheritance tax has bad reputation because it's often called the death tax, right? And indeed, it seems severe to punish people if they work hard, they accumulate wealth. At the end of their life, they want to bequeath it, and that is taxed. So it's somehow a discouragement to savings and to thrift. And so the idea is to tax inheritance, not on the side of the donor, but on the side of the receiver. And that makes a big difference, because you may, in the course of your life, receive several inheritances from different sources. And so the idea is to tax according to how much you receive in total, right, in a progressive way, with, of course, some exemption, as usual, for low amounts. And the idea is that this will encourage spreading the bequest around, so that people would not concentrate their bequest on just a few recipients, but they would be encouraged to consider charities, but also a wider circle of their families and
so relatives. Spread the money around. And fundamentally, as you say, it would take away the argument that you are penalising people who are smart enough to acquire wealth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
So if you spread it, if you distribute it widely, it might not be taxed at all.
Yes. Quite. Now, what I just must ask you about this very interesting sounding IPSP, the International Panel on Social Progress. This is all part of your big book. Who's in the panel and when can we expect it?
We are now finalising the text, and it will go to the publisher, Cambridge University Press, and it will be out before the summer next year. It takes a long time because it's such a big book. We will have three volumes, but we will also publish a small book that will be accessible to a wide audience.
And people can access it already online, I think.
And people can already visit our website, and the first draft of the report attracted thousands of comments. So that was really an open operation, and people can still look at the first draft that is very accessible on IPSP.org. So who is in this group? So we have all the disciplines of social science and the humanities. We have philosophers who help us with the principles of justice. We have sociologists. We have economists. We have specialists of law. We have Australian scholars in the group, of course. And Bob Goodin is in the Scientific Council. And we have Hilary Charlesworth in one of the other chapters. And Jeff Brennan from ANU in the chapter on principles. And we have been working under the moral authority of Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize in economics. And we have a few other Nobel Prizes in the group and many famous scholars. And that's a fantastic group. I must confess, it has been a real privilege to work with this group. I've learned a lot from this, and I encourage all our listeners to have a look at this website.
Sounds absolutely fabulous. We will look. And well done. Keep going. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Arlene.
And Mark Flourbet is Professor of Economics and Humanistic Studies at Princeton University, one of the 300 academics from around the world who've worked on this report called Rethinking Society from the 21st Century. It's so big that although the text is done, it'll take a year to produce and publish. Details on our website.